You folks in Spokane can sit comfortably already. Everyone else has taken that position. You know, the first few lines in the Song of Enlightenment, Shodoka, are there as the leisurely one, walking the way, beyond philosophy, not avoiding fantasy, not seeking truth. You know, many of the images in Zen, especially coming from China, sound almost idyllic and pastoral. Almost utopian, making it easy to dismiss as something distant from the hustle and bustle of contemporary scenes managed by clocks, computers, cement, and cell phones. The landscape and scenery that we often read about in Chinese literature is indeed different. But the mind being expressed, the one that is open to the vastness of what is being offered. So the landscape, the scenery is indeed different, but the mind being expressed. One that is open to the vastness of what is offered, the responding of trees to the wind, the response of flowers to the sun, and the reply of the creeks to rain is still available to us. The mind that woke up to the Venus star is your very own mind. And the body of leisure, within the vastness of Buddha fields is your body. Yes, the scenery is different, the culture different, the habits and attitudes different, but the yearning, the desire to wake up to what is not different. As I've said before, the hustle and bustle of our contemporary time is not the truth of reality. That is simply one offering. It is a proposition made by a culture of acquisition, competition, and indulgence. And we can choose. We can accept or refuse. We can turn towards or away. We can admit to the surface or look below or behind. There is the leisurely one walking the way, like a cloud or river back and forth, moving in the circle of wonder, trusting the spacious pathways in the Buddha fields. So how does one open to that? How does one nurture that heart mind? This heart mind of desire, of yearning to wake up, is at its bottom the heart mind of enough. It's the mind that knows how much is enough, and it knows how little is enough. And that is the practice of contentment. In Zazen, the shape, the taste of contentment is committing to your one and only practice. By committing and staying with Mu, by staying with hearing, by staying with each number, no matter the scenery or environment, no matter the hustle and bustle of the culture, no matter the decade or century. That is the practice of knowing what is and is not enough. No matter how many or few thoughts, no matter how many or few feelings, no matter how few or many sensations, your one and only practice is enough. No more is needed. No less is warranted. The posture we take is upright, whether on a zafu, kneeling bench, or chair, with body relaxed but poised, not leaning left or right. Eyes are not closed, neck isn't stiff, and hands are in one of two mudras. And you stay right here, whether rain or sleet or snow or sunshine. You stay here in the center. And the center is enough, because the center is actually multi-centered. And the self is displayed in array as the many beings of the universe. And though there may be no antidote for climate change and the havoc it will wreak, this mind, the mind of enough, of contentment, the mind of Zazen, is the antidote. Hui Nung wrote, "In your own heart mind, take refuge in realization and rely on it. Then bias and confusions won't arise. Reducing desire and knowing enough, this is what we call honor among the two-legged." So he said, in your own heart mind, take refuge in realization and rely on it. Then bias and confusions won't arise. Reducing desire and knowing enough, this is what we call honor among the two-legged. So I'd like to pause here and tell you a tall tale about the fabled sixth ancestor, Hui Nung. We say that he is the sixth in line after Bodhidharma, and that was probably true. We say he was an illiterate layperson who had a waking up experience, hearing a line being recited from the Diamond Sutra. That is probably not true. We say he was in a verse writing contest with the head monk, which again isn't likely. And we say he wrote the Platform Sutra, and again, this is probably not so. Yet the stories are great stories. And the stories about him are quite powerful, and in a certain way, are absolutely true. Something happened in and around the 10th century in China, and classical Buddhism, pregnant with possibility, gave birth. It gave birth to this thing that we now call Zen. The shape and language, the forms and fragrance of classical Buddhism shifted. the predominance of the old sutras shifted to the Lankavatara Sutra, to the Diamond Sutra, and finally to the Platform Sutra, which we say Huang Nong, Wei Nong, spoke to a crowd of thousands while conducting a Jikai ceremony. The following is an abbreviated tale of how he came on the scene. And if you'd like to know or read more, and I encourage you to do that, look at the first half of Red Pines, the Platform Sutra, the Zen teaching of Wei Nong, which he published in 2006. And so here is that abbreviated story. The young Wei Nong, as he was returning from the forest with a bundle of firewood, heard a lone monk chanting the Diamond Sutra. When the monk chanted, "Dwelling nowhere, bring forth that mind," something subtle but essential shifted in the young listener. He waited for the monk to finish his chanting and asked him where he could learn about such a thing as the Diamond Sutra. And the monk told him about the fifth ancestor, Hong Zhen. So the young man went home, immediately took care of his family's affairs, and then set out to sit and study with the fifth ancestor. After some time, Hong Zhen decided to retire and to name a successor. And so he announced a contest. He said whoever thought he might be ready to step into the teaching seat, whoever felt that strongly about his own nature, his own insight, should write a poem. And Hong Zhen would select the best poem. One night, the head monk wrote a verse on the wall of the monastery, and it said, "The body is the Bodhi tree, the mind like a clear mirror. Moment by moment, wipe the mirror carefully. Let there be no dust upon it." And there's all these different things that happen with this sort of story. These walls in the monastery had been whitewashed. You know, they'd been painted white so that scenes from the Lankavatara Sutra could be painted on there. But they were still blank. The painting hadn't started yet. So we have the essential sort of coming forward of the Lankavatara Sutra, which Bodhidharma really relied on quite a bit in his teaching. But then on this whitewashed wall in the monastery, the monk comes up and writes something that almost, but not quite yet, comes from the Diamond Sutra. And then Wei Nong, and I'll write you his poem, does come as an encapsulation of the Diamond Sutra. So you begin to have this shift from the Lankavatara Sutra and Bodhidharma, who's, as an East Indian person, you have this shifting into the Diamond Sutra, much more sort of Chinese sort of text, quote unquote. And then Wei Nong writes on there, and he's the one who then expresses the Platform Sutra, and you have this sort of huge shifting of tides and waves as we move in this 9th and 10th century of China. So it's a real sort of allegorical tale, and you know, pretty kind of cool, and it has so many different fabrics in it. Wei Nong is illiterate, he's a lay person, he's young and unread and knows nothing of Buddhism, and he comes and just hears this one line, whereas up until that particular time, you had to practice not only for years and years and decades, but for lifetimes after lifetimes And if you were born female, you had to practice in such a way that you would come back as a male. And if you practice as male, lifetime after lifetime, you had to practice intently so you'd come back as a monk. And then all of a sudden, Huey Nung hears one line and he has a waking up experience. And so it's not a monk, it's not an age-old guy who's been practicing for centuries or lifetimes. It's just this young, illiterate kid. And then another story rises up where a young girl, an 8-year-old, actually hears one of the Naga dragons give a talk and wakes up on one of the lines there. So this whole sort of way of being and understanding practice shifts, and it shifts in the person of Huey Nung, who maybe never even actually existed. So kind of cool. So anyway, let me just get back to what I should be saying because we only have a short time here together. But if you can pick up Red Pine's book, you really only need to read the first half, two-thirds, because that last part then becomes pretty didactic and is beginning to make a point so that, it's preaching that really this is the one and only way. And, it gets kind of tiresome, but the beginning is fairly radical. And you'll see the first time that we run into the four infinite truths, we run into the 10 precepts, we run into taking the refuge. It's really kind of pivotal time where these things that we take for granted, like, oh, they've always been said, for the first time begin to rise up to consciousness and become part of the liturgy and the lineages. So it's kind of cool. And Red Pine, as he always does, brings an amazing bit of scholarship, but also his iconoclastic bombast to the writing. So it's kind of a good read. Anyway, one night, the head monk wrote a verse on the wall of the monastery saying, "The body is the Bodhi tree, the mind like a clear mirror. Moment by moment, wipe the mirror carefully. Let there be no dust upon it." Then, according to legend, the young illiterate layman Huey Nung had another monk write his verse on the wall, which read, "Bodhi really has no tree. The mirror, too, has no stand. From the beginning, there is nothing at all. Where can any dust alight?" And in some versions of the Platform Sutra, Huey Nung says he also there composed a second gatha. He wrote, "The mind is the Bodhi tree. The body is the mirror stand. The mirror itself is so clean, dust has no place to land." And then here's another aside. One of my favorite Thich Nhat Hanh gathas is, "Listen, listen. The sound of the bell brings me back to my true self. This is the side of practice, continually returning to this now, continually dusting the mirror as greed, hatred, and ignorance arise relentlessly. Practice is to use the sounds to return, to remind you to come back. Practice is to use the thoughts to remind you to come back. This is carefully wiping the mirror, moment after moment, sitting period after sitting period, block after block. But the other gatha is, "Listen, listen. That beautiful sound is my true self. Each thing, sound, dust, thought, wiping, hearing, standing, sitting is it. There is nothing. There is nothing to come back from, because there is no leaving. For where could you ever go? There is no tree. There is no stand. And within that, reality has no limits. So anything real includes it all. So take refuge in realization, and nothing can be left out, because there isn't anything outside of it. Huineng wrote from the beginning, there is nothing at all. And so Zen stands on that groundless ground of open hands and open hearts. And that image of the old mirror represents the coincidence of opposites. And at the same moment, concurrently, it also represents the coincidence of mutuality. So both together at the same moment, like the front of the hand and back of the hand. It is duality and non-duality, and neither of those at the same exact moment. And this, of course, is impossible to adequately describe or explain, but it is exactly so in experience. And to touch the experience is simply let go of preference and aversion. So please, trust your situation, trust your practice, and trust your life. It has brought you to this moment, the best moment, the only moment to wake up in, and it and you are enough. And within that enoughness lies your own innate contentment.